I get a little squirmy on that kind of question. Now we're going to hear from Reggie Knox from the California Farm Link, which is a national leader in linking the outgoing generation with the incoming generation, giving both the tools and vision and clarity and calm that they need to keep that fluidity between generations of stewardship. We'll flow to you, Reggie.
Yes, I'm indeed very honored to be speaking to this community and after these amazing speakers and with these great ideas. First, let me just get a little bit of sense of how many people in the room are farming. Okay, wow, cool. How about more than 10 years farming? Okay, and how about farming more than 5 years? And okay, good. And how many accountants or CPAs in the room? Oh, darn. Attorneys? Okay.
Lawyers?
Yeah. Severin, can we work on that, getting more attorneys and CPAs in this movement? Because we rely on them a lot for the work that we do. Web designers? Social media specialists? Yeah. Okay, cool. We need all of you. So let me start with a personal story. I am a seventh generation Californian, actually, and I have agriculture in my blood. And my father was a nuclear physicist at UC Davis. And so they moved there in 1960 when there were 8,000 people in Davis. But he was an avid gardener, and it really inspired me in the garden. We had lots of empty lots around our neighborhood at that time. I did a lot of gardening, and I even got credit in agriculture for 3 years in a row to grow a big garden. It was an agriculture project, independent study kind of thing with a few friends. And then I went on to UC Santa Cruz, and I studied social change in the community studies department there. My advisor was a rural sociologist, Bill Friedland, who taught me about the politics and economics of U.S. agriculture and was very inspiring. And I also studied earth science and then ended up farming right out of college and really completely falling in love with farming and going to farmers markets and working with two friends who were in a partnership. One of them was Dennis Tamura, who had been the manager of the UC Santa Cruz farm for many years. And so it was kind of like an apprenticeship, but it was a paid apprenticeship. And I worked my way up into a management position. And at the same time, I was started volunteering with California Certified Organic Farmers and ended up doing some work for them over many years. And then worked in all of the many of the bigger sustainable ag nonprofits in California over about 20 years. So I've had a 27-year nonprofit career now with California Farm Link for the last 10 years and as executive director for the last 2.5 years or so. And my parents both fled from Southern California to the East Coast and then back out to Davis right before I was born. And they both passed away last year at 89 and 93. And we've been going through their stuff. And one of the things I inherited was two boxes from my grandfather, who was born in Los Angeles in 1884, my dad's father, and moved out to Pomona when he was 16 and became an office boy for the California Fruit, let's see, it was the San Antonio Fruit Exchange. exchange. And he I'm finding, I knew a little bit about him. I knew that he had orange groves, like a 10-acre orange grove, and I knew that he was involved with something called a fruit exchange, and that he later ended up on the Sunkist board. But now I'm going through these boxes of paperwork dating back to the late 1800s of his. And he moved, as I said, to Pomona when he was about 16 and was an office boy in the fruit exchange, and then became the general manager in about 1917. And apparently, I'm learning from these letters, there were fruit exchanges all over Southern California. People were moving into these little towns, and they were planting orange groves and citrus groves. And his career was really in organizing these farmers into different structures over this 50-year period, marketing structures to get their fruit to the East Coast market and to get it on the railroad. And so he was involved in detailed discussions with his congressman and with the railroads, and he was involved in lawsuits with the railroads about access to markets on the East Coast. And the fruit exchanges in these 12, 13 different communities got together. There was the California Fruit Exchange, and then I think there was even an American Fruit Exchange, and then it eventually became Sunkist, and he was on the Sunkist board for many, many years, and he was also involved in the manufacturing of packaging materials, especially things to put between the boxes on the railroad cars, and then later machinery to move the fruit onto the railroad cars. Anyway, I couldn't resist telling you that story, and it's been an amazing process of discovery. I mean, certainly an unsettling time to lose both your parents 5 months apart, but then to discover that working as an organizer with farmers was really in my blood. And so this is, 80 years later, 90 years later, I'm kind of doing one more generation of that organizing. It's completely different. So, okay. That said, there's the principles of the Agrarian Trust. That's an earlier version. That was about a week ago. I just wanted to put them up there so we can remember what they are. We've gotten some great other ideas, other principles that we might want to integrate from Gary and others. I think Severin's been working on them. There's 10 now, but they're great. They're really, they make me feel great about the work that I'm doing, and they're very inspiring. So let's keep working on them. I think it's awesome that they're on a wiki and that you all can comment and we can make them even stronger. They keep getting stronger. Mostly what I want to talk about is the work that we're doing at California FarmLink, and especially focusing on 1, 2, 6, and 7, helping farmers build equity and gain secure tenure to the land, helping farm families pass the farm to the next generation. We're really working, 6, with immigrant farmers a lot in California, with Latino farmers, and some with Hmong farmers in the Central Valley. A lot of female farmers. And we're also championing the legal approaches and legal arrangements and strategies for land tenure that exist, and raising awareness and understanding about those. Some data. Okay, I'm going to get into two slides with some recent data, but I also wanted to say that I was at the here, let me go back there before you get into the data, sorry. At a meeting of the Agrarian Trust that Severin and the Schumacher Center for New Economics organized on a beautiful ranch a few months ago, sort of a brain trust coming together to brainstorm these principles, and a bunch of groups from the East Coast and from all over the country joined us for that. And this national movement that we're building is really important, and the cross-pollination and the partnerships here have been super inspiring for me. So I wanted to share that. Now, the 2012 agricultural census, there's a preliminary report out. The final larger report comes out in May, but let's take a look at what we're seeing. So indeed, the average age, this is just California, average age of the farmer has gone up by about 2 years to 60. Turns out California has the fifth oldest average age of farmers now. This certainly underscores Severin's point about 70% of farmers retiring over the next 20 years and 400 million acres of farmland needing to transition to new farmers. Next, we see that the number of farmers with more than 10 years of experience running their own businesses is increasing. So once you've made it past the 10-year mark, you're definitely more stable. You're more likely to stick around. But in the 5-year period from 2007 to 2012, this ag census, there's been a 23% drop in the number of beginning farmers as defined by farmers who have been running their own businesses for less than 10 years. That's the USDA definition of a beginning farmer. So, and we ended up with only 36% of overall farmers in this less than 10 years beginning category. We were at 50 in 2007. The bottom line here is that the economic bust starting in 2008 took a huge toll on beginning farmers in California. And our staff out in the field working with farmers, we see this every day. And it's those first 5 to 10 years that are the most critical. And many of these upstart farmers have developed great farming skills before they go into business, working on other people's farms or apprenticeship programs, training programs, but they haven't developed the right mix of markets, the economies of scale, or the business savvy to survive in the downward economic pressure, particularly if a spouse or one of the farming partners loses a job off the farm. Our regional coordinator, Allie, in the Central Coast was just saying that she's talked to several people recently who had to stop farming because one of them lost the off-farm job. In the first 5 years, these beginning farmers are often on marginal land that is less costly, less secure, and harder to make work, or they may simply not have had the extra $10,000 in financing to get the business through the season profitably. And in the region where I live, in Santa Cruz and the Central Coast, farmers rely heavily on operating cash for very high-value crops that are capital-intensive. Strawberries is a great example. They take about $10,000, a minimum of $10,000 per acre in financing, in upfront costs. So if you're going to grow 10 acres of strawberries, you need $100,000 at the beginning of the season, just to give you an example. And that's how farming is done. And more than 50% of the strawberry farmers are Latino. Okay. So we've also been looking at this data on the number of small farms, so I wanted to put that up there just because it was interesting to see. We added the 2012. I've been showing this slide until fairly recently saying, look, the numbers of these two smallest categories of farms in California in the census up until, well, from 2002 to 2007, we saw a turnaround, and there was a substantial increase in the numbers of these small farms, which I thought was demonstrating what we're seeing, all this energy and excitement around farming and an army of new people that want to get into it. But then the economic downturn, and we see that these small farms have also taken a big hit. Now, while the small farms were increasing until 2007, the big farms were consolidating, and the numbers of big farms was going down. So I saw a lot of positive in that trend. But now we see that from 2007 to 2012, in the 1 to 9 acre category, there's 641 less farms. And in the 10 to 49 acre category, there's 2,269 less farms in California. Also of significance, while small and beginning farmers declined over the last 5 years, the number of Latino farmers in California, many of them immigrants, increased by 8% to almost 10,000 in number. And I'm going to be talking about access to land and capital, because those are our two main program areas. In fact, about 80% of FarmLink's borrowers are Latino, and about 40% of the farmers that we help with financial and land tenure coaching are Latino. These folks often come into the country with agricultural experience from Mexico or Central America, gain farming experience here as farm workers, and are very entrepreneurial. They have particular barriers to accessing capital due to language and other factors. Many of them have not yet adjusted their immigration status, for example, because we don't have immigration law reform yet. Okay. We definitely see all these new farmers interested in getting into it. This increased interest in food and healthy food access at all levels of society, I think, is driving this, and people developing the retail sector. But how many of these new farmers are going to survive? And without access to secure land, capital, and training opportunities, many will fail. Especially in hard economic times. So I just have some photos of our clients. I think that's Freewheelin' Farm in Santa Cruz, interspersed here. So this is what we're doing on the access to land side. We're helping farmers find land, coaching them on how do you go about looking for land, certainly making introductions to other farmers, sometimes putting an ad in the paper or using the county assessor's list, techniques for finding land. Once you find land, how do you negotiate a strong lease? We provide a sample base lease that we've worked on with attorneys. We've collected leases over the last 15 years. And our field staff in the three regions that we work in will sit down with a farmer and a landowner to customize the lease to serve the needs of both parties and get everything out on the table, from liability insurance to who pays utilities, who fixes the pump if it breaks, et cetera, and create a written agreement that we hope keeps both parties happy and creates a sustainable relationship. Passing the farm and ranch business and assets to the next generation. So there's a huge demand we have found in California for information on how to pass the farm businesses and assets to the next generation. So we work with a small network of CPAs, attorneys, and family communications specialists. This is a key element to hold farm succession workshops and conferences. We collaborate with what we've been doing. There's so much demand that we got some funding initially, and we developed 2-day conferences on this, with 1 month apart, with homework that the families did in between the two Saturdays, 1 month apart. We also did a lot of 4-hour workshops, but we realized that we needed to have specialists in each region, so we started switching over to collaborating with partners like the Alameda County Resource Conservation District or the Center for Land-Based Learning in Yolo County, and UC Cooperative Extension. And we'd do train the trainers, and we'd get, so it's a lot of it is the facilitation and the bringing in the attorneys and CPAs who know how to work with farm families and know that it's not just about tax avoidance, it's actually, there's emotional issues involved. There's all kinds of things you have to go through. So that we do breakout groups, and these are really intense. So I think, the demand is just not being met for this work. We had one workshop, the one in Yolo County, at an extension office. 100 people showed up, and we had to turn people away at the door. Mm. These are happy campers that we're working with to get their leases together. Okay. Oh, let's see, I missed. Sorry about that. Let's go back a little. I wanted to miss that bullet at the end, exploring innovative easements and leases with public agencies and land trusts. So we have some funding now to work with, to reach out to land trusts and to really encourage and support land trusts in getting more realistic about making land accessible, because there's a growing amount of land that's either held by land trusts or public agencies. So I'm including public agencies in the state parks, for example. And it's the leasing of that land has been quite haphazard. I mean, even recently, people were doing handshake agreements for grazing on land owned by big open space districts and that kind of thing. So a lot of the land is grazing land, but we're focusing on mostly on the limited amount of row crop land, and now we're switching over and focusing on grazing leases too, and trying to raise the awareness about successful and longer-term leasing strategies. And we're really learning from the East Coast folks, the Schumacher Center, the stuff that Elizabeth was talking about, community land trust. This is really cutting-edge material that we want to bring more out to the West. We don't have as much of it out here, so that's a really exciting area. Helping farmers finance and purchase land. So certainly we've tried to identify where the capital is for purchasing land, and we're now exploring creating an affordable farm mortgage fund as well. And I'm going to be talking about capital access here in a sec. So on the access to capital side, from the beginning of the organization in 1999, we took it upon ourselves to understand where the agricultural financing was and help farmers understand it. So what's the farm credit system? How about those low interest loans at Farm Service Agency? How do you get in the door for those? Community banks, the big banks. Turns out very few of these institutions are making small loans anymore. And in fact, I had a conversation with a gentleman at the Opportunity Finance Network conference who was an agricultural lender for many, many years, and now he was working for a different lender, not making agricultural loans. He was making loans to other small businesses, but he wanted to be in agricultural lending. And from conversations like this, it's become clear that as the community banks disappeared and as the infrastructure in the rural areas disappeared, those agricultural lenders that built the trust with the small farmers and sat down and looked them in the eye and made the capital accessible to them every year as they needed it, they're gone. There aren't, we have big banks, mostly. That's what is there. Not as many community banks that have the expertise to lend to farmers and understand crop cycles and all that stuff that you need to understand. And we're very excited about the new FSA microloan program, Farm Service Agency microloan program, but the demand is definitely not being met. So my predecessor, Steve Schwartz, former executive director of California FarmLink, raised the first $1 million for our loan fund. And then at first we didn't have our lender's license, so we started making loans through another nonprofit lender. And eventually in 2010, we got our lender's license from the state. And in 2011, we got guaranteed status from the Farm Service Agency so that we can make guaranteed loans. And they'll cover 90% of our losses if we have losses on the loans that are FSA guaranteed. But they take longer, and there's a lot of restrictions and that kind of thing. So only about a quarter of our loans are guaranteed by the Farm Service Agency. And then in September of last year, we became a community development financial institution. I'm going to talk more about what that is because I want you to know and understand these structures. But it's exciting. We also try to keep abreast of what Slow Money is doing. We have a partnership with Kiva Zip. I know they're represented here. They've been talked about earlier today. So helping people access, you know, internet sources and alternative sources of capital is key, and Kickstarter and all, you know, the whole mix is really important in this new alternative capital world and that we're making do with in the absence of a robust credit system throughout the country for small farmers. Individual development accounts. Another thing I want to say is the big banks just don't make these small loans. Our average loan size is about $25,000-$30,000 because they're not profitable, and these are mostly beginning farmers. They don't have the track record, higher default rates, and so that's the niche we're filling. Oh, IDAs. We've raised money to do match savings account where a beginning farmer puts $100 a month in a bank account. We match it with grant money to the two or three to one. We were doing 3-to-1 for a while, so we'll put $300 a month, and at the end of 2 years, during which time the farmer has participated in financial literacy courses and credit counseling and that kind of thing, the farmer has $9,600 to put towards an asset for the farm and build equity in the farm. So, and we're doing some advocacy to get that funded at a federal level. That's our lending director, Anthony Chang, on the right. Just some accomplishments from 2013. We linked 23 farmers with land and negotiated leases to support farm businesses. 13 of them were startups in business less than 3 years. Helped 13 existing farmers find additional land and negotiate leases. Made 29 farm operating and infrastructure loans, 80% Latino growers, 28% women. Average size, as I said, about $25,000-$30,000. Provided one-on-one coaching to over 300 growers on land tenure and financial management. Partnered with all kinds of institutions and nonprofits throughout the state to reach beginning farmers. Did 36 trainings and workshops, and ran a national program with 12 other states training the trainers to run agricultural IDA, individual development account, or match savings programs. So it was a busy year. We do. Yeah. So that's this slide. So right. How have we built this loan fund, Severin? Thank you, Severin. We now have $2.7 million, a revolving loan fund. We're building the capacity to do more loans every year. We're hoping to do 40 to 50 loans this year. Most of them are operating loans of under. For a year long term, and that's another reason that big banks aren't so interested in them, because you don't get much interest in a short period like that. So these loans are very much subsidized, and I want to tell you about where this capital is coming from. So how many people are already familiar with what a community development financial institution is, a CDFI? Okay, cool. A bunch of you. That's great. And how about the Community Reinvestment Act? Yeah, great. Okay. So I'm glad that there's more than 20 people in this room that know about these things, because we're not using these tools enough in the sustainable ag community. In my experience in California, very few of us are tapping into these resources that really come out of the civil rights movement. The Community Reinvestment Act came about its roots go back to civil rights and to redlining, when the banks said, we don't lend in these neighborhoods. This is a black neighborhood. And so a regulatory framework was developed, and it's evolved. It keeps evolving. But depending on the size of the bank and the regions it operates in, each commercial bank undergoes different types of requirements, but basically they have to provide money to the institutions that are going to make those, that are going to make those loans to the low resource people and to the small businesses. So becoming a community development financial institution in 2013 gives us access to money from the Department of the Treasury. Their last round of financing was $68 million, for example. We got a $600,000 grant to support our lending activities last fall. And those grants go up to $2 million. It's a fairly, by my standards, seeing what the USDA gives out to our little granting programs, this is a pretty robust program. It's the best deal in town, as one of the program staffers at the CDFI told me. And it's all for the purposes for lending to low-income people and doing community development for low-resource and small business. There's 800 CDFIs who have access to this money around the country. And under the Community Reinvestment Act, whether you're a CDFI or not, our initial million, way before we became a CDFI, was from the big banks who are forced under this regulation to do grants and investments. So I work with both the investment people who put the largest investment was $1.5 million in our loan fund from Rabobank and other, like Comerica, Wells Fargo, put $250,000, $300,000. These are low interest loans at 0 to 2% that we can use in our revolving loan fund. And also individual investors who have contributed to our loan fund, sometimes for specific regions or with specific kinds of impact that they're interested in making. Theory of change. You can build strong local and regional institutions to help beginning farmers access land and capital and training. Theory of change to help farmers access land. So I think we do have to build our own institutions, and I think Wes said that last night. He said the institutions are all wrong in this country because the people who settled this country were poor people settling in a resource-rich land that was scarcely populated. Now we have wealthy people in a land with dwindling resources that's with a lot of people in it. And so we've built our educational institutions and all our institutions for this other, with a whole different perspective in mind. So I think it's important that we build our own strong institutions like the Agrarian Trust, and that's what we're trying to do, is really build something significant here that has capital, that can be a player in the financial world with small farmers. And we've got to fix our existing institutions too. We can't, you know, the USDA has $90 billion a year that they spend, right? We can't just ignore that. So advocacy is of utmost importance in our strategy for social change. Partnerships, working together, not reinventing the wheel. Helping and encouraging farmers to know and use existing business and legal tools creatively. And sharing and promoting alternative land tenure models. So I just got back from Washington, D.C. Just a quick note on advocacy here. We work closely with the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, and we're trying to get appropriations right now for an individual development account program for small farmers through the Farm Service Agency. So I met with legislators who are on the appropriations committees. And there's 104 organizations around the country that are members of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. And the take-home message is just that you really can do a lot with very few people to change the way these institutions operate. And we have people like who are in Washington who will help us do that with the Sustainable Ag Community. So get to know your friends at NSAC and Jeannie and her friends at Calcan who do a lot of this in the state capital here. Partnerships, we work closely with the Agriculture and Land-Based Training Association, an incubator farm in Salinas that also started a marketing arm that has about 50 mostly Latino growers who market through Alba Organics now. They did $5 million in business. We finance those growers, and we're developing loan products like little lines of credit that meet their needs. For Mandela Marketplace in Oakland, who has a distributorship, a retail store, and runs a corner food stands to create access to healthy food for urban low-resource people, we're giving purchase order advances of $10,000, $20,000 to some of the 25 farmers whose produce they distribute. We customize a financial product for those growers to help them have cash flow during the season. Just want to put in a pitch for this new revised version of Growing on Solid Ground, a guide to land tenure for farmers and ranchers. Out in front, we have a preview of it, just this 10-page thing, but it kind of outlines our new strategy. And we're really revamping it. We're going to have case studies in there to talk about different land tenure models that we've been working with, and really try to break down these legal tools, business structures that farmers can use to succeed as small businesses. So I think that's it. I'm out of time. Thanks so much. Thank you.